Okay, let's go ahead and get started. I'm a Presbyterian and we run things by the clock. I'm a German and a Presbyterian, so we doubly run things by the clock. Before we get my name's Ty Fisher, and if you're supposed to be in the workshop for teaching the great books, lo and behold, you're in the right place. Before we get started, let's pray. Heavenly Father, we thank you for this day. We thank you for this conference. We thank you for all that we've learned and been challenged to learn. We pray, Lord, that you would give us wisdom to learn from your word and wisdom to learn from our fathers in the faith. Father, I pray that this workshop would be for some people an avenue or a venue to begin or to run with even more vigor down a path of learning from our fathers. We pray that in Christ's name. Amen. Okay. I'm going to ask a question first. And I'm going to pause pregnantly, which is very difficult for me to do. Is there one root of all of the deepest human longings? I will repeat the question, being that I really can't do that pause thing. Is there one root of all our deepest longings? Is anyone brave enough to give an answer? Yeah, okay. Okay, wow. That's a pretty good answer. That almost anything that agrees with what I'm about to say, I would judge to be a pretty good answer. Things that don't agree with that, or maybe even supersede it, are marginal answers. Okay. Yeah.
How about a righteous man with a dilemma? How does he deal with a righteous God?
That's a problem. Is that a longing, though?
Well, he wants to have fellowship with a righteous God, but he doesn't know how.
Okay. So all of us, being that two of us have spoken at this point. All of us are basically pointing back to this problem with lost fellowship with God. And I think there's something to that. The greatest poet that ever lived thought the same thing. Oddly, he linked many of our deepest desires to one of our senses. Does anyone want to guess what sense it was? What sense it is? You know, you have five senses. I don't remember all of them, but they tell me you have five. Which sense is it? No, it's not sight. Come on. He's younger, so I can do that. Anybody else? What sense would you think it would not be? What's the sense that always kind of gets tossed off the edge? Smell, a sense of smell. That's exactly right. He said that it was a sense of smell, that basically our deepest desires are linked to a sense of smell while we are asleep. Now you know. This might sound weird. It might even sound indefensible, but listen to the entire story before you make a judgment. The poet, the great poet, of course, is Dante. And he stands on the top of Mount Purgatory in the second volume or the second part of the Divine Comedy in Canto number 28. Now, just as an aside, I already told you if you were here on time. Sorry, ma'am. I told you I was a Protestant, okay? I don't think there's a big mountain on the other side of the world, but this is really good poetry. This is my favorite part of my favorite book besides the Bible. He's on the top of Mount Purgatory at the apex, and at the top of this mountain, and I'm going to run over here. At the top of the mountain, after Dante has been, here's the world. And hell is in the middle of the world. Okay? Now, see, I have to correct one of the things that you've probably heard about medieval people, and that is that they have this kind of earth-centric view of the universe. Okay? That is true. But it's usually played off as they thought we were so expected us on the edge of the galaxy, on the edge of the big universe that's spinning like a flat pancake out in space. You know how big it is, it's too big, you know.
That's the truth. They did think of the universe as the middle, kind of as the earth as kind of the center, but not in the sense of a positive way. They thought of it as kind of like you think of the drain in the bathtub. And it's where all the bad things sank to. So, basically, worse than bad things sank to the center of the earth, and that is Satan is upside down. And in Dante, that was really cold. And you can put the bottom in. See, I don't know where we got the top thing. Dante said Satan's big arms kind of are air conditioning hell. Okay, so we know that hell is not in the planet. But Dante has this great journey he goes on, and he has to go down into the center of hell. He actually has to do this little turnaround thing while he's climbing down Satan's leg, which is really neat to think about, because he hits the center of gravity on Satan's leg. So he's climbing up, and then he realizes he's going to climb down again. He gets a little confused. Well, he learns what sin is really like in hell. But then he goes around to the uninhabited side of the world, which is fascinating. Up here in Europe, thought that this other side of the world is uninhabited. And there's a big mountain down there called Mount Purgatory, where Dante goes up that mountain and is sanctified. He learns all the Christian virtues. And at the top of the mountain, after he's forsaken, and after he's repented of all his sins, after he's learned to be what he's supposed to be, he re-enters at the top of the mountain. He gets back to Eden. He gets back to the earthly paradise. Okay? And that's where this whole smell thing comes in. At the apex, the poet has been on quite a journey. He's seen hell and he's seen sin as it really is, without illusion. He's been taught all of the lessons of suffering as he's climbed this mountain with the poet Virgil. He's about to be cleansed by the waters of forgetfulness and good remembrance. He's almost ready to jump up into heaven. He's almost ready to meet Beatrice, kind of the sacrament of all God's grace in bodily form. And then he does what no doubt you and I would do if all this great stuff was happening. And that is, he gives a lecture on meteorology and a short lecture on botany, which, of course, you'll understand here in just a second. He gives this lecture on meteorology and its effect because he looks up and he says, he notes this: all of the winds are blowing out from Eden. Okay? They're all blowing out. And this has two effects. The first one has to do with, you guessed it, strange plant life. He tells us that the wind blows out from the top of this mountain and it blows little spores and seeds all over the world, kind of replenishing. So if you've ever seen a field of daisies, and out in the middle of a field of daisies, there's this one kind of non-indigenous plant. You know, I don't know what would in your big bank of azaleas down here in Atlanta, maybe you'd have like a tulip from Holland just popping up or something like that. Well, Dante had seen things like that. And he said the reason that those popped up is because the wind from Eden, gentle breeze, is kind of carrying out these spores and maybe, I don't know, tulip bulbs, who knows, out over the whole world. Okay? There you go. Now you know. There's another strange effect, though, and I want to read to you a little bit from a note in Purgatory, Canto 28, line 136. This is the Dorothy Sayers edition. Okay. So, okay, you know it has to be good. And Dante's talking to the Lady Matilda, who's about ready to wash all his memory away. And she says, Sayers says, the lady now has fully answered Dante's question, but as kind of a bonus, she throws in the hint of the second thing that Dante believes about this wind, that those the dreams of a golden age which have haunted the minds of poets and indeed all men from time immemoria are a dim racial memory of paradise before the fall. This memory belongs to man's nature. It is a gift of revelation, but common to heathen and Christian alike. It follows that when we today contemptuously call such dreams nostalgic, which means homesick, we are unwittingly calling them by their right name.
for they quite literally arise from man's longing for his true and original home. So Dante says, when you're sleeping, that scent of Eden that's carried out all over the world, and you know, if you're snoring, maybe you wouldn't get as much of it, I don't know. But you're there and you smell that. And you're full of this remembrance, this longing to be home. Thus, we're really longing for Eden. The scent of it, says the poet, comes to us in the night when we slumber and stirs us with this love. We're longing to be back in the presence of God, with Him in harmony with the world and with each other. Every time we corporately worship God, we both enter into this reality and we hope for a final, permanent entrance into this reality. Every marriage points to this longing. We all want to go back home. Okay? Well, that's good. What does this have to do with the teaching the great books? Well, number one, this is a great book. But I'm gonna try to tell you a little bit about that. Let's go to our outlines. And what we're going to talk about is how you should teach the great books. I'm the headmaster at Veritas Academy, and I teach usually a class or two. One of the classes that I've normally taught at Veritas is a class called Omnibus. I'm the managing editor of the Veritas Press Omnibus curriculum, which are big, thick books, and they cost a lot of money, but they're really good. So it's been my privilege over the last 10 years to be doing a lot of reading and work on this kind of stuff. So I'm going to talk to you a little bit about, first, teaching the great books as a path that inspires honor and love for our fathers. And the first thing under that I want to talk to you about is the present problem of Protestantism. See my alliteration? And now I go to slang. Who's your daddy? Okay? We have to take this question seriously. If our faith goes back no further than Luther, then this is not to disparage Luther or Calvin or any of the reformers. Or even worse, if it only goes back to Pastor Scotty's garage in 1973, we're thinking is not really right. There's that scary part in the Nicene Creed that says that the church is one holy Catholic. In my church, it has a little C on Catholic. Catholic and apostolic church. Okay? One holy Catholic and apostolic church. If we're not part of that thing that goes back through history, I would just say, well, what are we part of? And Protestants have this unnerving tendency at some points to pretend that our history is really only either back to, you know, Pastor Scotty in 1973 in his garage, or it's back to Luther or Calvin at best. This view, if we recognize that we are connected, we are the children of people like Augustine and like Dante, it doesn't keep us from criticizing them. You see, I just criticized him. I said that there's no big mountain on the other side of the world from directly across from Jerusalem. I think it's just ocean. Dante was very fretful about traveling into the southern hemisphere. He didn't think that man should live down there. And he thought you'd be punished if you tried to take your boat down there. He said Odysseus was punished. That was Odysseus's last trip, was down. Odysseus saw purgatory and then just got washed under. You weren't supposed to go to the southern hemisphere. This is an argument because the church calendar is backwards in the southern hemisphere. So I've always kind of wondered about that. This doesn't keep us from criticizing our fathers, but we should read them first before we criticize them. Okay? Have you ever thought about that? If you're a parent, don't you want your kids to understand what you're trying to tell them before they start criticizing you? We should criticize them with humility. And finally, acknowledge this, that we are their children. Okay? And the second thing we should look for in teaching our inspiring honor and love of our fathers is the ooh and the ah. The ooh is that kind of great idea, that kind of rational understanding of something. And I'm one of those guys that, you know, sits around sometimes. I'm just kind of thinking on the back burner, and I go, "Oh yeah, got it. Now I understand." I usually don't understand things immediately, but I understand them a while later. But we also have to look in our students to get this sense of this sense of appreciation, wonder, and love. If you have not listened to it before, I think you can get this from wordmp3.com for a nominal fee, I think $2. Go back to, I think it's the 1998 Kansas City ACCS Conference, and George Grant has a talk called The Theology of Wonder, Augustine's Theology of the Psalms. I think it's actually the reason why I'm part of ACCS in a very deep way. It was so good in Kansas City that I can remember looking at the ceiling a couple of times just to make sure it was still there. I mean, it was incredible. I've almost wrecked my car listening to it. So go back and get that. But we want to, as Sayers says, in the logic stage, sometimes you have these pert kids who are really kind of, you know, tearing things apart. And then there's something good about that. But as they go into the rhetoric years, we should really seek to inspire this kind of admiration and love for their fathers. The next consideration is just this. There's this pesky thing called the fifth commandment. Now, you might not have looked at it recently. I looked at it before I came in here. And it says that we're supposed to honor our fathers and mothers. Our culture, however, worships youth and intuition. Okay? Intuition, Thomas Aquinas is not big on intuition. Okay? You read him and it's this laborious, logical laying out of everything. But know this, our culture is always rebelling. It's rebelling as quickly as it can. It will rebel against tomorrow's ideas today if it could figure out a way to do that. Okay? We must be always reforming, but never being revolutionary or rebelling. Okay? We have to honor our fathers and mothers. And if the great books represent the work of many of our fathers, then we need to honor them. And I would say by reading them. The next thing is this, that we should seek to inspire honor and love of our fathers by viewing education as a cultural heritage. And your reading list on the end of this, some of these thoughts come from Wendell Berry's essay called The Work of Local Culture. It's critical for us to found a culture of succession, a culture in which children follow after their parents and love the same things that their parents loved. That's honestly, if you dig down to the deep heart of what classical Christian education is about, it's that idea is very close to the center of it, that we would pass along our stories and our loves to our children. In understanding that that culture of succession is one that we want, and actually one that is normative, okay? Even in the pagan world, in the ancient pagan world, it's normative, okay? Odysseus is lost. His son goes looking for him. Odysseus's plan, Odysseus, by the way, leaves, you know, this island pleasure paradise with Calypso to go back home and live with his family so that he can raise up his son, Telemachus, to take over Ithaca after him. That's just, to be biblical with you, you know, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. They all kind of go together, don't they? Okay. One, the work of the father is completed by the son, David and Solomon. It's the normal pattern of things. When we realize that's the normal pattern of things, we can only be massively distressed at how much that pattern has been forgotten in our age. Our age we have a culture of supersession in which children are trained to make their parents obsolete by outmoding them. Okay? You know how to do email, but they have Blackberries. So eventually, they're going to replace you in your job and they're going to send you off to a quiet place to sit. Okay? That just, the ancient world would be flabbergasted by that kind of a concept. I have stories that pass down through my family. My family's lived in the same place for a long time. And I teach those stories to my children. I'm going to try to teach one to you. Now, I have to change the names, though, because the descendants of these people still live around where my family lives. Once upon a time, I grew up in a river town, which explains a lot. You know, there's a roughness. There's a, you know, people kind of sliding in and out at night. A lot of murders in my hometown. I grew up in a town of 7,000. And 1 week, Paul Harvey announced that we were the murder capital of the world. We had 3 murders and an attempted car bombing in 1 week. Oh, in a town of 7,000. The one murder was first called by the police staff a suicide, and then they realized the gun was found in another room, and they said, that's probably a murder. I said, probably so. Probably so. But back in the old days, these would be the days of when my grandmother was a child, we had a coroner whose name was Gus. And my grandmother describes him as a bandy-legged man. Now, I think what she means by that, she never really explains, but I think what she means is his legs look like a bird legs, like a rooster. He's a little kind of bird-like man. And he wasn't a very important guy, but he liked to be important when murders happened. So this murder happened on the hottest day of the year, and the coroner is to go down and pronounce the guy dead. So Gus, instead of walking the 2 blocks to where the body is laying, which would have taken about 10 minutes, he walks back and forth through the town, stopping at every barbershop and grocery store to let them know the important task of the coroner. Well, it takes 2.5 hours for him to cover these 2 blocks. And the funeral home director, Paul, is waiting down there at the body on the hottest day of the year in the Ohio River Valley, where it's really hot and humid. Well, this little bandy-legged fellow shows up, Gus, looks at the body and says, he's dead. At this point, Paul pulls back and punches it. Punches Gus, lays him flat out on the ground. Well, this offended his sense of dignity. And in a small town, of course, they probably had the trial almost immediately. He complained to the judge. They had the trial, and the judge brings Gus to the stand, and Gus tells the whole story. He says, I was just doing my job. I walked down there. There was Paul. I saw the dead man. I pronounced him dead. And he punched me in the mouth and knocked me down. And you've got to punish him, judge. Well, the judge looked over at Paul and said, did you do it? You know, is this true? And he nodded his head. He was a big hulking man. Nodded his head and said, yes, it is true. And the judge said, well, you have to pay a fine of $25. And Paul pulled out his wallet. He walked up to the bench, put $50 on it, turned around and hauled off and hit Gussie. Knocked him flat again. Okay? Now, that's a story we have a lot of fun with in my family. My 3-year-old can tell you that story. Now, what's great about stories like this is every generation improves the story. Okay? So eventually it turns into mythology, but it's great. They have a cultural heritage that we're trying to pass down to them. Okay, you need to have that. Now, some of that comes from this. Okay, some of that is going to be common to all of our families. Some of it's going to be particular to your family, and that's going to give a great sense of diversity. And you know, all of our bread's not going to taste the same. Okay, the next thing is teaching the great books as a key to the liberal arts. First, we have to answer the question, what are the liberal arts? Well, in a conference on classical Christian education, we should know something about those. We talk about the liberal arts being the trivium, grammar, logic, and rhetoric. But the 7 great liberal arts also include the quadrivium, which arithmetic, geometry, music, and astronomy, not astrology. That's different. Okay. But those 7 great liberal arts are really what we're teaching kids. Now, we focus on the skills of grammar, logic, and rhetoric, but you have to see if the quadrivium is made up of music, geometry, arithmetic, and astronomy, at least except astronomy, you probably work some of that into your training in the trivium, right? It's not like we're going to start arithmetic in college. We might want to start arithmetic in college, but hardly any of us put that off that long. And geometry the same way. And most of your kids are learning music as well. So look at the liberal arts this way. The liberal arts are a liberation from the narrow thinking that we are prone to, so that we can live as free men and women. Okay? That's really what the liberal arts are about. The liberal arts work to prepare people to live in free society. Okay? To prepare you for the responsibilities that you're going to face as free men and women. Well, how can this set of books, these great books, be a key to them? Well, I would say it's a key in this way. It walks us through all of the old stories, and it binds, binding the love of one generation to the previous generations. Okay? My kids, I tell them all these stories about Dante. I'm walking them through the, we have a tradition at my house, which you should start at your house. It's called Winner, Winner, Chicken Dinner. Okay? Anytime we eat chicken, everybody has to tell a story. Okay? Now, sometimes I think my wife selects against chicken because she's tired of hearing all the stories. Every time we have chicken, we tell stories. And I have a 3-year-old. I have an 8-month-old. She's not good yet. I have a 3-year-old, a 5-year-old, and a 7-year-old. And they take their best shot at it. And we tell them who wins at the end of the thing. Well, my contributions, which are not usually the winning ones, come from the Aeneid right now. So I'm kind of walking them through the Aeneid. I want the stories that are precious to my wife and I to be precious to my children. And we're going to bind them together with us in those stories. And know this, that these books represent a long discussion on important issues. We walk through them as a curriculum, and we learn to listen to what our fathers say to us. And then finally, we learn to talk. We learn to ask questions of them. Okay? So, the great books, I think, are a key to thinking through the liberal arts. How can we put the key in the ignition would be the next thing. And I would just say this. Start reading thoughtfully and corporately. Okay? You've probably heard that. Someone's probably told you in your high school health class, you know, you really have a problem if you're drinking alone. Okay? I just took a drink alone here, and no problems. But if you want something dangerous, read alone. Okay? Read a bunch of books alone. Okay? Have you ever met somebody like that? They've read like 86 books on the same subject. The only problem is they can't talk to anybody about it because they're here and everybody else is there. Read books thoughtfully and as best you can corporately. And then sit, and this is so easy. So then just sit down and talk about what you read. this objection comes up sometimes. But aren't these books really hard? I'll just say this. Dante, first time, read Dante. Read the Divine Comedy. It's great. The first time you read it, don't hope to get anything out of it. Just read it. Okay? The second time, it'll start to get a little sweeter. But honestly, how many of you like coffee? Like coffee? A lot of people like coffee. I've seen you drinking it out there. Okay? You like coffee. The first time you had a coffee, did it really taste good? Come on. Not unless you mixed a ton of cream and sugar in it, right? Now, how do you drink coffee black? That's foolish, honestly. Because once you get the cream and sugar in there, you should just keep putting that stuff in. But Dante's like that. He's an acquired taste, but it's worth acquiring. So you say the books are hard. Well, honestly, they're a lot easier than books about these books. Okay, have the Sam I Am approach. Try them. You will see. They're good. Note this as well. Discussing these things should be enjoyable. Okay. What that means is you should learn to respectfully and vigorously argue with each other. Okay? So many times, you know, it's honestly, in society, as you interact with other Christians, be peacemakers, right? But peacemakers, being a peacemaker doesn't mean that we can't disagree. It doesn't mean we can't sit around a table and get aggravated at each other. Try to convince, try to persuade. Okay? What happens? Now, here's the thing. What happens if we would turn the key and start the ignition? I think this is what I've experienced. We start seeing people kind of wake up. And you realize a couple things. First, you realize how poor you are. You realize that the education that you got in high school was not good. Okay? How many of you had those awful, bad anthologies that you had to read in high school? Okay? I remember, I love the Iliad. Okay? But I remember all I read was one book of the Iliad. And I was like, this doesn't make any sense. Why is that one guy chasing the other guy around the city? He just keeps chasing him. Okay? He killed him. It's great. Doesn't make any sense. Okay? Really, the anthology would be super if you already knew the book really well. Okay? But they didn't prep me on that. Okay? So you realize your poverty, but you also realize that your forefathers were wise enough to store up treasure for you, and they meant it for you. That's pretty good. I mean, that'd be a nice thing to wake up to. And finally, you end up with culturally literate kids, which is really fun. Okay? You teach the great books. You sit down and discuss things. I'm going to tell you a story. This is a heartwarming story for me. This is a big, big year for me. My first graduate is getting married this summer. Okay? Wow. Never thought that would happen, especially with some of the graduates we've had. I never thought they'd. As I used to say in class, some of you need to consider these issues concerning marriage. Others of you probably not. But I have a graduate getting married. Well, here's what was really neat. First, he's bringing his fiance home, and who does he call to come over and have dinner? Well, he calls two of his omnibus teachers, two of the guys that have sat around and basically argued with him for... I had this guy for, I think, four consecutive years in omnibus. So he invites us over, and there's one teacher and his daughter who was in that omnibus class. And then this guy has a brother who's been in omnibus. We're all sitting around the table, you know, trying to be polite for a little while. The food's served. And this guy rides around on nuclear subs in the summer, and I'm always afraid. I did not get all the ethics I wanted to on nuclear warfare across to this kid. So we're all kind of sitting there politely, and then somebody makes some offhanded comment about nuclear holocaust, and everybody jumps back into the old discussion. I'm afraid we almost frightened the fiance to death. I mean, she's like, what's wrong with these people? But you get this taste for that kind of talking, that kind of relating to each other, that kind of arguing, thinking, and discussing. And that's good. That's good. It's good to be thoughtful. Third point, teaching the great books as a prerequisite to wise and righteous action. Okay? There's a right way to read a book. And this is going to sound weird. It's all about now. Or better yet, it must not remain only about the past. Okay? Books are not to be read as if they were a distraction to life. Okay? That's bad. Don't read a book that way. I'll say it this way. It's a striking way to say it. Every book you read is about you. Okay? It's about your life and about your community. You're learning so that you can live. This is a story that happened to me. I was foolish enough. First time I taught Aristotle. Okay, then this was 6 or 7 years ago. Taught Aristotle the first time. How many of you have read some Aristotle? Good. Great. Super. Easy read, right? Okay. I was about one day ahead of the reading for the students. So here's what I did. I assigned... let's start out here. How many pages? Go home. Read 50 pages of Aristotle for tonight. So, you know, I said, well, I can do that too. So I went home and I'm reading my Aristotle. Okay, Aristotle's language is thick. Okay, not thick like molasses. Thick like steel. Okay? So you read to the end of the first paragraph and you go, I didn't get that. You go back up, you read to the end of the first paragraph again, you go, nothing. You read to the end of the, and you're like, I assigned 50 pages of this, and I can't do one paragraph. Okay? Well, I stayed up most of the night that night because somebody needed. There were a couple smart kids that I had who came in bright and fresh the next day because they had just stopped. Then there were a couple of kids who, you know, they laid their heads down, and I was like, you know, it's my fault. It's my fault. But I read Aristotle on his book of ethics, and it was on the justice of a transaction. Okay, the justice of a buying and selling transaction. Okay, now basically the way our world works usually today is, you know, you go out and you charge whatever you can, and people pay whatever they will, supply and demand. Aristotle said, it's not justice. He says that the justice that rectifies things is a justice that takes into account. I'll give you a for instance. It's a justice that basically says, let's say you had a car, and you know your car is supposed to last for 5 years, you know, but let's say it lasts for 5 days. Okay. If you take that car back after 5 days and you say, you sold me a junker, the guy wouldn't give you all your money back. Okay, he would only give you all your money back minus the 5 days that you should have had the 5 years. Okay, well, that's great. And to complicate things during this time, we were having our first accreditation visit. Okay, very frightening. Kind of like the Nazgul flying in. Okay. So, of course, I had already decided what was going to make the big difference in accreditation. I had all my clothes laid out. I bought a new pair of shoes because that was really what was going to make the difference, you know. Well, in Lancaster, if you get household help, my wife was doing some art teaching at the time. If you get household help, often you get Amish ladies. Well, there's something that Amish ladies don't understand, and it's called dry clean only. Okay. Okay, so the day before the accreditors showed up, she machine washed all my dry clean only clothes. So I started to pull them up and got about to my knees on the pair of slacks. Okay, that's one strike. Okay, I decide I'm going to. I bought my shoes, some great Bostonians. They were super. Bought them for $100. Had my shoes and I got my shoe polish with it. You know, because you want to polish your shoes eventually. And, of course, I'm not going to know which polish to get. So I said, which polish should I get? Well, the day before the accreditors show up, I go down the basement. I get out my Bostonians. I've worn them for, 2 months, I guess. It's time to... I take the liquid out. I put it on there. It immediately takes all the color off the brown shoes. They turn white. So I lost my shoes. Too. So I've got two strikes there. Well, then I go on. We had the accrediting visit. I'm reading Aristotle on the justice that rectifies. Okay. Well, I happened to go back to the shoe store the day after I read Aristotle. And I took my shoes, took my polish, and I said, there are the shoes. There's the polish. You did this to me. Now you give me my money back. And this guy, I don't think he'd read Aristotle, but he said, no, you have to pay me like $5. I said, why? Don't you want to be a happy customer? He said, well, you had them for 2 weeks or 2 months or something like that. And I was just stunned that Aristotle had kind of come in my face here. So I paid him. I mean, I guess I could have pressed on to the management, but I was like, how can you read Aristotle and then go out and not do that? Now, that's just a little example of how things can apply. But the book that you're reading is really about you. It's about how you live. It's about how you are going to take ideas like justice and bring them about in your world. Okay? The great books also help you answer three great questions. And here they are. Who am I? Where am I? And what am I doing here? I would have to tell you that as far as I've gotten on trying to define what a real education is, I think it's giving substantive and meaningful answers to those three questions. If you can answer those questions on a very deep level, I think you're an educated person. Okay? That's just a provisional answer, but that's what I would say. I do want to point this out as just a little aside. None of those questions can be answered without reference to God. None of them. So, Logically, if your school can't talk about God, you can't give anything like a real education. Okay, I told you, take that and go. Everybody won't see it that same way, but I think it's obvious, right? If an education can't really tell you who you are, where you are, and what you're doing there, it's not an education. It might be tech training. Okay, it might get you a job somewhere. It might get you into college. It's not a real education. Okay. Next, the great books as an entrance into the great discussion. Here's the interesting thing, and I'll give you probably the greatest example of this, but it's common down through the ages, and that is that as this list of great books kind of passes down through the ages, everybody that kind of enters into this discussion reads them, and then they talk to each other. Okay. Everybody's dealing with Aristotle's ethics, or at least everybody is kind of when they get back in through Thomas Aquinas. Everybody is in some ways in ways that aren't good, but they're everybody's thinking in reaction to Plato. Everybody is kind of pulling and tugging on each other. My favorite example of this is the example of Luther and Erasmus. Erasmus, the great scholar, trying to distance himself slightly from the Reformation so as not to end up in the ecclesiastical huskow, writes his book on the freedom of the will. Okay, I think he was hoping for something kind of innocuous, differentiation from Luther, you know, keeping him at arm's length. Luther reads the book, right? Luther's not a tame person. Okay, so that's what Luther's answer is. The bondage of the will, on the bondage of the will, which is basically a theologian having a scholar wander into the field of theology and Luther trying to beat him to death with a stick. Okay, it's like a mugging. Okay, Erasmus wants to say something that's just kind of, you know, peripheral. And Luther starts off by saying, so thankful that you address the heart of the matter. I'm sure when Erasmus read that, he said, wasn't mean to do that. Just trying to put a little distance there. Okay, but that's what I mean by a great discussion. When you read these books, you're able to enter in to see down through the ages how people have reacted to each other. Okay, now here's the scary thing. Using metrics. Now, metrics are basically trying to, every once in a while, you need to kind of stop and ask yourself, are we being successful? Okay, you should probably do that every so often. Here's the tough thing. The tough thing on this is it's really, you know, it's not like, okay, I had a kid read 2,000 pages last semester, thus I am successful. Okay, you have a kid read 2,000 pages and you could score zero on success. Okay, because what you're trying to do is foster a not just the learning of the data, but the love of learning and the love of discussion. Here's the best metric I have. Look at your graduates and what they're doing in 10 or 20 years. Okay? I know that's a really hard metric, right? There are little signs you can watch for along the way, though. And this brings me to another happy moment, which I did something that I shouldn't have, unintentionally. I had a graduate, and he was probably a junior at that point. He's graduated now. And he called me and he said, hey, Mr. Fisher, I'm going on vacation next week. What should I read? Whoa. I start. Yeah, think about the kid. I said, I'll call you back later. Let me think. So I'm, you know, looking at all my lists and stuff. And the book I picked for him was The Count of Monte Cristo. Okay. Now, I have this great abridged version of The Count of Monte Cristo that's 600 pages long, and I didn't realize it was an abridged version. So the regular version is about 1,400 pages long. So he gets back from vacation. I call him. I said, how'd you like it? He goes, what are you talking about? You sent me away on vacation with a 1,400-page book? Ooh. Sorry. But if your kids are asking those questions, that's good. Okay? That's good. It's funny. At some points, we get kids going away to college now, and you know, I talk to them about what they're reading. Their reading lists in college are paltry. Okay, some of them went into engineering against my advice. Actually, very fittingly, they went into engineering. But the stuff they have them read, I think one time one student only had to read, the only what I call a real book that he had to read was 1001 Arabian Nights. That was it. The whole semester. I almost cried. The last thing to think about is the hope and the glory. Okay, so we've got to get them to love the things that we... First, we've got to love the things that we should. And then we've got the challenge of getting them to love the things that they should. Well, if we can do that, here's what I hope. Somebody said, well, you know, why are you doing what you're doing? And I said, I'm not really sure. And they said, how are you going to know if you're successful? And I said, I think I can tell you that. I think that if Lancaster County, where I'm from, is different and better in 50 years because of what I've done, then I will have succeeded. Now, the only problem is I might not get to see 50 years from now. Okay, so you have to do a lot of this on faith. But I can tell you this. If you get kids to love these kind of books, you are going to be making a definite big problem for the kingdom of darkness 30 years from now. More problems than you could cause yourself. And that should make you go home at night and smile. Okay? Because I think if I could get all of you to start doing this, and then like 30 years from now, I could just sit back and I could sip some sweet tea and just watch everything happen. And that would be so fun. So help me in this project. Well, here's a few things that I think could wreck your ship. So watch out for these. I call them two things that Odysseus faced. He had that choice, you know, Scylla or Charybdis. You know, you either have to go and face the monster who's going to eat some of your crew, or the big whirlpool that's going to suck you down to the bottom. Oh, he's got the dilemma. So the first one is syncretism, which is basically a failure to maintain antithesis. Is your allegiance ultimately with Jesus Christ? Okay, or is classical an adjective to Christian, or is it at the root of what you're doing? And the answer is Jesus Christ is at the root of what we're doing. Okay, if I educate really, really bright kids, if I educate them so well that they shine like stars in the heavens, but they don't follow after Jesus Christ, the grade I'm giving myself is F. Okay, the act that we're doing is an act of devotion to Christ. Don't fail to maintain antithesis. We're not Greeks. Okay, we're not Romans. We're Christians. We're not Americans in the deepest sense. We are Americans. But down at the root of our being, the great division that you're going to recognize throughout most of your life, which is going to happen in eternity, is not, you're not going to, the 4th of July is not going to be the biggest holiday you celebrate in 10,000 years. Honestly. Okay. I like Christmas better anyway. The next thing that you have to avoid is what I've called schismatism. Okay. It's not a word. Okay, but it's clinging to the prideful view that you really have nothing to learn from your fathers. Okay, at that point, I would say don't read these books and nothing really needs to be discussed. Just sit and be content with the answers that you already have. Okay, if that's the way you are, that's really sad. I'm not against catechizing kids. We catechize the kids at our school. We teach them the Westminster Shorter Catechism. But the catechism is not an end. It's a beginning. Okay. In the logic and rhetoric years, we teach them to debate, to discuss, to argue, to try to persuade. And if you really think that all you need is a catechism, you know, and if you treat a discussion as if it's really just a catechism, you know, it's like that teacher on Ferris Bueller's Day Off, right? He asks the question, anyone, he gives the answer. He asks the next question, anyone. Could there be a worse situation than that? Okay, you shouldn't be counted truant for that. The best essay I ever received started something like this. It was, I forget the question now, but it was about Voltaire's Candide. And it started off this way. It said, Mr. Fisher thinks that the answer is X, comma, but he is wrong. That was the thesis to the essay. I remember at that point I stopped, I set it to the side, I grabbed this big red pen that I love, tucked it behind my ear, and I said, okay. And I wrote at the end of it, you're right. Okay. The student taking me to task, and he was exactly right. Okay, it's amazing what you'll learn if you walk down this path. The next problem you could have is hypocrisy. You know how you smell Eden and get that longing like I talked about at the beginning of the thing? Kids smell hypocrisy. That even if they're deeply hypocritical themselves, okay, they smell it. Any kind of adult hypocrisy kills the love of learning. If you ask them to read what you won't read, stop. Okay, please stop. Okay, find something you like to read. Read that. I've had. If you introduce the book, you're not going to like this book. I bet you will have a self-fulfilling prophecy on your hand. Oh, this book is. Oh, it's so hard. You won't like it. Okay, don't read it then. Why are you making me do things that are not good? Okay, and then the last one I would warn you back about is a lack of patience. Okay. What we're doing is to be joyfully difficult. If you're not experiencing both the joy and the difficulty, I don't think you've hit it right. Okay. Also realize this, that every time, and we've, I think some of a lot of the folks here at the conference have been working with me on the Omnibus Project, and we've tried to lay some tracks that make it a little bit easier than what we faced, you know, 5 or 6 years ago. But it's still I tell you, you're gonna, if you haven't read Aristotle's Ethics, you're gonna go, nope. You're gonna do that, and that's okay. Okay. It's amazing how quickly you can become an expert. You read like 3 books, you're an expert. At least culturally, that's pretty much true. Those are things that you should avoid. Now, the last thing is I have to give you, in the last 5 minutes that I have, some secret knowledge. Okay? And maybe you've realized this, but I did it not knowing what the other guys were going to do. But almost every speaker has talked about St. George. Have you noticed that? I was on the conference planning committee, and we didn't slip a note to everybody to do this. Okay. Now, my first name is George Tyler Fisher. I didn't know I was named after St. George until... but he's kind of become a metaphor for, I think, this movement and for my life. How many of you are familiar with Spencer's Fairy Queen? It's not read a lot. Get this version of it. This is book one of the Fairy Queen, Fierce Loves, Faithful Wars. And if you ever see Roy Maynard, I've called him up. If you ever see him, you should pat him on the back for doing this. It's got all these little notes that tell you what the hard words mean. And he points out these great little notes. For instance, at the beginning of each canto, it has a 4-line little a poem. And he notes, which all of them can be sung to the tune of Gilligan's Island. For instance, the faithful knight in equal field subdues his faithless foe, whom false to SS says, and for his cure to hell doth go, his cure to hell doth go. Kids will bite on that. But I need to tell you a little bit about St. George, because I'm figuring you're probably going to get it 3 or 4 more times. The great thing about St. George is he's like us, okay? He's like us. And he puts on his armor, okay? Really, George means farmer. So he's not a knight, okay? He's just kind of a farmer boy that gets somehow, we don't really know how, gets this knighthood on him because everybody else has basically been burned up by the dragon. So he puts on all his armor, but Spencer points out as he's riding off that the armor's all dented up. You know, it's like you got a football jersey that's covered with mud. But Spencer says, but this guy hadn't really been in any fights. Okay, so it's borrowed armor.
Okay, this is our great hope to go out and slay the dragon. He's basically had to like muck his shirt up just so he looks like a knight. Okay, he gets what he does. He gets tricked by a magician, messes around with another girl, a witch, even a yucky one. He almost commits suicide. Finally, he gets taken to the house of holiness and learns the three great Christian virtues. He learns faith, hope, and love. Basically by being tortured. Okay? He learns his true identity from a hermit. Okay? He goes out to fight the dragon and he gets whooped up on by the dragon the first day. Now, that's not a technical term, but I did hear it used in the conference. He gets whooped up on by a dragon the first day. The only way he survives is the dragon with his tail knocks him back into this well, kind of like baptism. Okay, he gets knocked into the magic well by his opponent. Okay, so they think he's dead. He pops up the next day. He goes back to fight the dragon. He makes some dents with his sword on that day. I think he cuts off a foot or something of the dragon. But basically, he gets whooped the second day and roasted. But as he gets blown backwards by the fire, the dragon knocks him back again. Oh, it's kind of providential. Knocks him back into the tree of life, which happens to have this salve running out of it. So basically, this dead roasted knight lays in the salve all night, and you can guess what happens. He comes out even stronger. And now, what the purpose of this whole talk was to read you one part of Book 11 of the Fairy Queen, talking about the third day and talking about the dragon. The dragon is the he in this. After St. George says, taking advantage of his, the dragon's open jaw, ran through his mouth with so inopportune might that deep and pierced his darksome hollow maw, and back retired his lifeblood forth with all did draw. Now here it comes. So down he fell, and forth his life did breathe, that vanished into smoke and cloud swift. So down he fell, that the earth him underneath did groan as feeble, so great a load to lift. So down he fell, as an huge rocky cliff, whose false foundations waves have washed away, and dreadful poise is from the mainland rift, and rolling down great Neptune doth dismay. So down he fell, and like a heaped mountain lay. That's a good story. Okay? Reading the great books, on some days, St. George Day, by the way, is April 23rd, if you want to write down your calendar. And I just kind of walk around the house kind of saying this over and over. Now, my kids, there's a great children's version of the story of St. George. And your kids should love that, because it lets them into, really in a very deep way, who and what we are. Okay? God bless you. Thank you.